right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. My name is Bryce. You guys know me. I am today not joined by your favorite of the duo, Mr. Aaron Pizzamine Malone. Aaron is at physical therapy. Poor guy. He's really, really working on his posture. And he's the guy just builds miners and podcasts and trades all day. So I think it's a little bit of a bad back, but he's going to be back in shape in no time. But today I'm joined by another fantastic counterpart here that we could speak to today, Alex Shipp, who is from Offshift, who he's the chief strategy officer. And we're going to bring Alex in to talk about not only decentralized finance and crypto, but something him and his team are donning, PryFi, private DeFi. So Alex, welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Oh, thank you, Bryce. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we couldn't be more excited. And this is one of my favorite topics and Pizza Mind's favorite topic. So I wish he was here, but I know he's going to be watching the recording. Now let's just zoom out real quick before we dive into PryFi. Let's talk about you. Alex, who are you and why are you the right guy to be leading strategy for such a bold initiative?
Well, I guess I'll start with a little bit of my story. I will say that we do have quite a collection of really brilliant people on our team and then also our partners as well. My basis or sort of my foundation or how I sort of stumbled into and found crypto started in, my background's in finance. I studied finance in school. And then I was working at, and I've told the story a couple times in previous interviews as well, but I was working at a financial services firm that did consulting with bulge bracket banks, and they specialized in distressed debt. So if those banks had loans out that where the loan recipients, the debtors weren't going to be able to repay those loans, this company would then contact the banks and say, hey, you guys are going to be dealing with some distressed debt. Have us come on as a consulting unit and we'll help you get that fixed up. And so they would specialize in a certain macroeconomic sector that was experiencing a lot of distress. In the case when I was interning there, it was 2013, 2014, around that time. Actually, it might even be a little bit later. I think it was actually a couple years later, but they were experiencing, they were focused on the exploration and production for oil companies that were drilling for oil and oil was tanking. So it was my job to go through a Bloomberg terminal because that loan data is public and to sort of look through and find the companies that were going to be able to repay their debt. I found very quickly that all of the companies weren't going to be able to repay their debt.
And it was that's not a good discovery.
It was explained to me politely and patiently that we were just looking for companies that weren't able to service their debt. That means pay the interest. And so that sort of set me off in sort of an uncomfortable place where I was like, it kind of seems like financial interests literally own all of the companies in the world, which are just desperately trying to service their debt. And at the end of the loan term, they need to pay off the principal by getting what's called a bridge loan, which is where the bulge bracket bank, in this case, or the financial institution, pays or gives them a new loan to help them repay the principal from the previous loan.
At a much higher interest rate.
That can often happen. I mean, so if you're not running the business in the way that financial institutions like, you're really at risk of default constantly. So it took me a few more years to really stumble onto crypto, but my entry into the space came from one of sort of monetary unease, so to speak. And it sort of led me to go as deep as possible into what money is and then what finance is and sort of to determine for myself that we need a better system. In other words, most of the problems and ills with the world that we're living in are systemic ills. And so we need to sort of not reimagine, but also rebuild, our monetary and financial landscape from the ground up. So when I discovered Bitcoin and then progressively into Ethereum and then progressively into the role that privacy plays in our systems, it was certainly the right fit for me.
So debt, right? That's a big concept and it's rearing its nasty, ugly head quite a bit again now, we're recording this year, end of March, and things are, in the sovereign debt world, getting pretty sticky, corporate debt. Do you have kind of a hot take on just what the geopolitical kind of landscape is and where this is taking, these debt markets?
Well, I'm certainly not going to make any predictions, off the cuff. I think, though, anyone, once you get involved in this, money is principally It is an organic emergent phenomenon, and so is credit for that matter. And that means it operates on a sort of basis of a distributed intelligence that has to do with decisions that are made by economic agents at the individual level, and they're aggregated in a sort of very natural process. Anytime there's any form of centralized control or any attempt by humans or by man to sort of guide or control these sorts of very complex processes, we destroy the systems that we built on them. And so anytime like the institution of the Federal Reserve or central banks at all is inevitably going to lead to the kind of situation that we're finding ourselves in now. It's kind of like blowing a lot of air into a balloon. It's really difficult to say where a particular bubble is going to emerge. People have already labeled this kind of massive bubble one as the everything bubble. I don't think that's a bad term at all. It's hard to say, is it going to be the housing sector? Is it going to be student loan debt? Is it going to be, as you said, corporate debt? It's really hard to say.
Sovereign debt, right? With Russia defaulting on all of their loans and all of Russia's corporates who are saying, hey, you know, all of our contracts are debt denominated in dollars. We don't have any. You're getting rubles.
Yes. I mean, and also, as you say, geopolitically and regionally, it's hard to say where this sort of thing like and you could look at Evergrande and the Chinese real estate sector as well. But I think the most important thing to realize is that it's when we focus on these, I mean, this is how government and centralized authorities function and how they continue to thrive, which is by focusing on localized specific issues and presenting themselves as being in a position to resolve them, which is where the ills or the problems are systemic and they require systemic and decentralized solutions. So yeah, it's hard for me to say where things are going to melt down or explode first, but yeah, I mean, it's on the way and it will be pretty serious for a lot of people that aren't prepared.
And just, you know, again, nothing that we say is financial advice. This is purely educational in nature. But for as a guy, you know, who's specialized in, you know, trawling through, you know, Bloomberg terminals, looking at debt, I just flashing back to Michael Burry in The Big Short when he's going through his terminal and finding all these, you know, bunk subprime mortgages. But, you know, to your point, you said, you know, the meltdown is going to happen. It's going to come in one shape or another from one market, whether it's sovereign debt or whatever. But does that necessarily translate into, you know, a 2008 type financial crisis? Does that translate into, you know, a capitulation in the risk markets? Or do you think that it's something that could be contained? And again, you know, this is just all, you know, speculation and just conversational, but I think it's worth at least talking about.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's important to note is that people have been saying that US dollars will be used as toilet paper since like 1971, you know. And so one thing that I've learned is I'm 29 now. But, you know, one thing I've learned from being in my 20s is that the world operates on longer time horizons than many of us are often familiar with, which is that, you know, a 20-year investment or a 10-year investment for something for someone who's in their 20s is kind of unfathomable and difficult to conceptualize. Whereas a more experienced seasoned investor, simply by virtue of being alive longer, can say, okay, a 10-year investment or, you know, there's a lot of there are a lot of people calling for crises and there's a lot of, you know, fear sells, you know, no matter which side of it you're on. And yeah, I mean, again, certainly like once you institute the centralized controls, once you institute, once you kind of destroy the decentralized nature of money and credit and markets, you're setting the stage for some kind of implosion down the road. Like absolutely. You're creating imbalances and those imbalances will need to correct. In this case, again, I can't say where in particular. But yeah, we are heading towards something that is, I mean, how it will unfold is another question, because I think that's what you're really getting at, which is, you know, what is the response that people will have? And there's kinds of Brent, I'm forgetting his name, but the dollar milkshake theory, if you're familiar with that.
I'm not actually.
Yeah, his point, because a lot of people are talking about this runaway inflation concept, which is certainly totally valid. And, you know, but of course, since all the debt of the world and his it's a reference to the film There Will Be Blood with these oil, you know, sort of tycoons. And one guy saying, you know, I don't care where you're setting up your oil field. I will, you know, suck all the oil out from underground. That was sort of like a milkshake with a straw. And that was he was sort of saying that all the liquidity of the world will go to the dollar. And his opinion is that as there's more runaway inflation, as there's eventually there will be actually people will need to pay their debts and there will be a capital flight out of assets and back into dollars to pay those debts. And so yeah, I think there's just
absolutely.
Yeah, it's so, so hard to predict. And anyone who says that they know what's going to happen next definitely doesn't. And anyone, that's also a sign that you aren't fully grounded and objective as an investor, as a trader, or simply as a human being. So it's super, super difficult to say. I mean, I just think there's a lot of, what I will say is that I think the amount of volatility that we've seen in markets since the establishment of the Federal Reserve and since like the widespread sort of establishment of central banking in general is totally unnatural. And that
because all these centralized kind of authorities distort real prices and real interest rates, right? By kind of fixing them arbitrarily, you distort, you know, true market principles.
Yeah, you do. And you create asset bubbles. And again, their response will always be up. Oh, there's this localized bubble. We need the government or we need some kind of, you know, monetary management to be able to manage this, to handle this, to suppress this. But it's all coming back to the same problem is always at the beginning is the desire for control. And that's really what causes the volatility. So what I will say is that I think we're headed for very volatile times. Mm. And we're already seeing some very volatile times, whether it's with inflation or and you see it extend to the crypto market, too. I think that's something really important to mention, which is that the crypto space is absolutely not immune to the whims of central bankers, all sorts of different volatile marketplace and industries, like whether it's real estate markets or anything that could cause capital flight, that could cause a bank run or anything could absolutely affect crypto assets as well.
Yeah. No, I think this brings us to a really interesting kind of segue because Bitcoin was born, 2008 was when the white paper was authored, kind of in the heart of the darkness of the financial crisis as this response to all of these, you know, people waking up to like, hey, you know, we're occupying Wall Street because these centralized authorities that got us into this problem are now getting bailed out. And so we need this decentralized alternative. And so, you know, Bitcoin was the first iteration of that. Now, then after that, we had, you know, Litecoin, which is kind of the same, just faster. We had Ethereum, which was kind of new 2.0 type, you know, smart contracting. And, where does Offshift kind of fit into the picture? Are you guys building a new Bitcoin that's, you know, better, faster, more private? Are you guys building a platform to help people transact Bitcoin privately? And kind of what's the high level here?
Well, I like what you sort of set up there, which is a nice, the transition from Bitcoin to Ethereum and like the DeFi landscape. To elaborate on that a bit, I think, you know, it's really important to go through this. And I spoke about this at FCC in July of last year. And it's really important to understand that a lot of people see fiat currency as some sort of perversion of money. In other words, a perversion of gold. And it's not really. It's really a perversion of credit. And the difference is that money is those units of actual value, and then credit are the IOUs, whatever you want to call them, bonds, their receipts, their claims to
somebody else's liability.
yeah, that's well said. Yeah. And so credit always emerges as a sort of flexible and versatile laminate that sits atop money because money and its inherent characteristics, which make it suitable for exchange, in particular its scarcity, also require some energy and transaction. And so credit is always cheaper to exchange and it also allows more versatile forms of exchange in the same way paper could be used for shares of stock. You can have derivatives instruments, you can have insurance, you can have all sorts of different products that money could never support alone. Yeah. Even today, gold is settled in cash, in other words, paper. So credit is not the problem in and of itself. The problem is that the issuance of credit is centralized. And we have these systems where credit is really controlled by one issuing authority or a network of small issuing authorities, which are all sort of beholden to that one central bank, that central issuing authority. So when we look at sort of like gold was sort of taken from its place as this global monetary standard, not because, I mean, it was never exposed as being unscarce. It was that the system of credit on top of it had some issues. So right now we have like a really brilliant system where Bitcoin is a really sound money, and in many ways more sound than gold, and I won't get into that argument, but Ethereum built on top of it for the first time, like this age-old civilizational problem that has existed for maybe millennia even, where now there's a way of conducting different sorts of credit applications, you know, credit transactions where you can loan and you can receive loans, you can have derivatives products, and again, you have insurance protocols and everything. It's really exciting, and it's all in decentralized format. So
DeFi.
DeFi, as it's called, decentralized finance, and finance referring to those credit instruments. So the issue is that all this is sort of taking place in the virtual domain. The virtual domain is the home, is sort of the foundation for these applications. And unfortunately, in the virtual domain, data is very easy to collect copying and pasting it is essentially what's called rehypothecation. Rehypothecation is the process of creating another claim to a unit when the unit itself doesn't exist. And that's a problem we have with banks. That's a problem that we've had with centralized credit issuance over the years. And unfortunately, in the virtual domain now, is all you have to do is see data to be able to copy, paste, and essentially rehypothecate it. And that's what we see in the social media space, where Facebook and others, it's basically a meme at this point that Facebook or Meta is evil. Social media companies rehypothecate or take our data and sell it. They monetize our data. But most people don't know that, for example, Robinhood literally monetizes your money. They look at your trades, they sell that data hedge funds, they make $700 million a year. It's a great gig for them. And in the same way, you have Chainalysis and Nansen and these on-chain data analytics companies, which are totally looking through all the Ethereum transactions and all the smart contracts on the blockchain, and they're taking that data. And so you have privacy from a humanitarian standpoint as a human right, and then you have this whole data economy emerging, where you have that Economist article from 2017, 2018, where data is now the world's most valuable commodity, more valuable than oil. And so we need to sort of bring privacy into the mix. Privacy is the key component that scarcity, really, privacy is scarcity in the digital domain. And so we need private decentralized finance. That's really the missing piece. And so PriFi is sort of the fitting name there.
Yeah, no, I love it. That's a really fantastic overview. And it tells us a little bit more about the nature of privacy as like kind of a fundamental human right, as opposed to just this thing that people are like, oh, you know, we want privacy to hide from the government, right? Like, no, it's part and parcel of our kind of human rights to not get leveraged by centralized authorities, essentially. And so I like, you know, kind of reframing the narrative. You know, a lot of the times people are like, oh, private cryptos are only for bad guys. It's like, No, that's not the case. Private sort of ecosystems are for the sovereign individual who kind of wants to reclaim a little bit of ownership over their digital footprint. It's just kind of an interesting dichotomy. You know, people are always, you know, kind of naysaying about privacy. How do you navigate that? Like, you know, do you get a lot of haters that say, oh, you guys are just building technology for bad guys?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, that was super, super well said. One of the most eloquent, articulate things I've heard said about privacy I would think you're in the privacy space somehow. Can't say enough. There was a woman named Kathy Ho, who was one of the lead lawyers in the Silk Road case. And she I forget if it was said I believe it was just published or in some way, but 99% of fiat denominated money laundering goes unprosecuted. So that's a pretty huge number for us to
pretty
be
staggering.
It is staggering. Yeah, it is. Because, you know, it's kind of like, and this isn't commentary on gun laws or anything like that, not entering into that space, but it's kind of like someone being, you know, you see someone inventing a new kind of knife and you say, oh, that knife is dangerous, it could hurt people. It's like, well, but okay, but that's not really the primary method of you know, these kinds of, you know, violence, especially, you know, so I'm not even going to go near that topic. But if we're not really preventing people from conducting money laundering for illicit activities in fiat currency, then targeting these kinds of blockchain-based privacy solutions doesn't even really make sense in the first place. Mm. And I mean, again, if we look recently, HSBC was recently revealed, I think, having laundered like hundreds of millions of dollars for drug cartels, like knowingly, not even like it happened on this decentralized protocol and they knowingly did it. Mm-hmm. And then now it's coming out that Credit Suisse did basically the same thing with, I think, even more money. Mm-hmm. And so we have banks like these top tier bulge bracket banks, which are already doing this stuff and basically don't even get slapped on the wrist and then get bailed out. And we're like, hey, look at that protocol over there. It doesn't make any sense at all from that perspective. But I think if you get really into it philosophically and get away from the names and the numbers and everything, privacy is a really important, it's a really important piece. It allows for self-expression in a lot of ways. And just ask yourself, you know, the kinds of things, the way you modify your behavior, just even when you're in public. It's certainly that we're always different than we are in private. And in private, it gives us an important opportunity to grow and examine ourselves. In addition, though, and I think this is really important, is that, you know, surveillance is a, it's really a prerequisite to control. It really is a prerequisite to authoritarianism. And so as long as surveillance is on the table, authoritarianism is only one leader, one event away. And so as long as we have privacy, that's available as an option. And that's our attitude at Offshift, just to have privacy available. It's one click away, a one-stop, one-click opt-out from the public domain, then people have that choice. And authoritarianism is really further at bay.
Let's face it. We've all gotten burned by crypto at one point. I mean, I know I have, right? One day you're up 167% or whatever. And the next day you're deep in the red. But remember, great investors know when to reinvest their gains. And this may shock you, but many elite crypto whales are reinvesting their gains into an unexpected alternative asset, and that's blue chip art. So from 1995 to 2021, blue chip art prices outpaced the S&P 500 by 164%. And this could explain why a crypto billionaire recently invested hundreds of millions of dollars into physical art. And even if you aren't flushed with, Bitcoin billions, well, you can still diversify with art like those guys, all right? And with Masterworks, the revolutionary investing app, you can actually invest in art. You can invest in a Warhol or a Banksy, for instance, all for less than a tenth of a Bitcoin. Sounds like a good deal, right? And for a limited time, they're giving Crypto 101 listeners a special offer. And to find out what that special offer is, head to masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, that's www.masterworks.io/crypto101. It's important as well to see the important Regulation A disclosures at masterworks.io/CD. And we're going to put that in the show notes as well. I guess if we, because I want to touch on just the concept of like how, right? How is this all possible? And I know it's probably some complicated cryptography, but can you give us the 101 version?
Yeah. It's some complicated cryptography.
All right, next question.
Some super complicated cryptography. To be honest, because a lot of people ask us like, who are your competitors in this space? And there are a lot of other people building brilliant privacy solutions and power to them, and definitely not disparaging other people that value privacy. But we don't have anyone that's really doing the same thing as Offshift, which is building an on-chain privacy solution. That means on Ethereum layer one. And on Offshift, you can burn the native token XFT, and you can mint these ZK assets, which are inherently, we could call them confidential tokens, but they're mirrored, they're synthetics that mirror other assets, BTC, ETH, USD, committed fiat currencies, commodities, real world assets, crypto native assets, whatever. And you can be fully private while being fully on chain. As we say, no ifs, ends, or bridges, you never leave Ethereum. You don't go onto any layer twos, no rollups, nothing like that, no relayers. So the challenge there, and the reason why a lot of people haven't really been able to do that, is because Ethereum uses what's called an account-based transaction model. And most privacy-centric systems are built on UTXO models, like Bitcoin, for example. And on a UTXO model, which stands for unspent transaction output, you just have these lists of transactions on the ledger from one address to another, this many Bitcoin, this many coins, this many tokens were sent. And so if you can simply shield or obfuscate that data, then you can create a very quite easily a private system, because all of the concepts like account balances and things like that are being handled by higher levels of abstraction, like, for example, like a wallet application or a block explorer, something like that. But on Ethereum, in an account-based model, which is important for state saving, in other words, DeFi applications definitely benefit or actually almost require an account-based model, you have this concept of an account that's at the core protocol layer. So simply obfuscating the transactions is not going to suffice. So on our model, we use sort of a hybrid between the UTXOs and the account-based model, which is a bit more to explain, but essentially they are what are called cryptographic commitments, which are exchanged between these accounts. To go into any further depth, I would probably take up a lot of time, but I also would probably want someone on the team with a really deep technical background or one of our cryptographers to go any deeper than that.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Basically what it sounds like to me is like you could convert your token, your XFT, was that right?
That's
XFT
correct.
Tokens. You could burn that as gas essentially to mint a private digital asset. Is it like an ERC-20?
So yeah. I mean, you're not using it as gas though, because I mean, it's a one-to-one, right? You're just burning it and minting the same amount, the okay. same value. You're still going to be using Ethereum for gas.
Gotcha. And so I guess the one of my other questions was the cost associated with, you know, kind of getting into the offshift ecosystem. The cost would just be whatever gas fees for Ethereum are at that time.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, there, you know, as the famous saying goes, there's no such thing as a free zero knowledge lunch. So we use bulletproof ZK proofs are the secret sauce. That's, and then zero knowledge proofs are by and far one of the biggest, I think, one of like the most exciting sort of emergent themes for 2022 and beyond as far as what they can offer for scalability and privacy. Mm-hmm. So obviously they're computationally intensive. We use bulletproof ZK proofs, but yeah, there's a cost to be paid there for the privacy. And then of course the Ethereum gas fees. So as we sort of say it, it can be pricey, certainly, but that is the cost of decentralized privacy that's on chain in 2022. You know, it's kind of like asking, you know, if you try to send a video by email in 1999, it would probably take forever. And you'd say, well, it's not the technical solutions, it's just where the internet is at this stage. Mm-hmm. These are our capabilities right now. So yeah, the cost will be what the cost is. And hopefully, you know, Ethereum 2.0 and all of these questions will sort of sort themselves out.
Yeah. What's the high level go-to-market strategy for offshift? You know, are you guys looking to first and foremost get liquidity for the token? Are you guys first and foremost looking for other partners to leverage the product?
Well, I mean, for liquidity is certainly a top priority for us. We just extended our LP rewards programs on SushiSwap and PancakeSwap. And because of the way our tokenomics function, as I've spoken a lot about, anyone can look into the at Denver talk I gave quite recently, where we talk about our tokenomics and the imperative of liquidity for the tokenomic model that we use. But I think that, you know, as far as we're launching our mainnet very, very, very soon. So that's really exciting. And it's really a huge milestone for the Ethereum community in general, for cryptocurrency in general, to have on-chain privacy. We're really augmenting a key technical component to the Ethereum core protocol. So we're excited about that, and people in the privacy community are certainly excited about that. Beyond that, once we have these ZK assets live, so to speak, on mainnet, I think that's when, as someone who's, I'm really the BD guy, that's when my life starts to get a lot more exciting. Rather than just writing op-eds and doing AMAs and things, you know, get out there and say, yeah, what can we do with these ZK assets? You know, and you know, can we, whether it's building privacy-centric applications that integrate them, whether it's getting out to existing, you know, public incumbents in the DeFi space, and how can these be integrated? What does that look like technically? That's when you get some really good technical minds together. And I think it'll be really exciting to see what comes next.
Okay, here's one question that I kind of have first comes to mind is, who's your dream partner? Like, what would be the dream partnership for offshift that would take you to, you know, maybe the next level? Maybe, you know, kind of come to my mind, MakerDAO, right? That could be a cool partnership, you know, obfuscating, you know, some of the on-chain sort of NFTs that they have, so that people could, you know, operate in that ecosystem without leaving, you know, a footprint that could get analyzed by their competitors, for instance. Is there anything that like you've been really, you know, chewing on these days?
No comment. No.
don't want to give anything away, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that from the events that, you know, especially at Denver recently and talking to a lot of other projects in the space that are, you know, some of the, what I would call blue chip DeFi platforms, I am very excited to see what we can do. But again, like mainnet has to be live.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't want to speculate. And that's why I don't want to name any names. But I think they really are just, you know, within arm's reach at this point for us, because we've had those conversations. But yeah, more importantly, that stuff needs to go live. I mean, one thing I will say, that one of our existing partnerships, or I wouldn't call it a partnership, but, you know, we are live on Moon River as well, which is...
Oh, yeah. Cool. The Polkadot thing, right?
Yeah, it's a Kusama's... Yeah, it's Moonbeam's Kusama iteration. So they're you know, EVM compatible parachain, which is, you know, to us, like, we don't want to compromise on decentralization ever. Otherwise, we're just moving backwards. You know, if you want a really fast solution, just go ahead and use Visa. So to us, Moon River was a really good opportunity for us to give traders that prefer a low-cost environment an opportunity to use our platform. So we are happy to be launching there as well, so that, you know, it'll, for cost-conscious traders, there is an opportunity to participate.
So when you were at ETH Denver, you know, largest Ethereum hackathon in the world, what were some of the other kind of key trends, or, you know, like you guys are building PrimeFi, that's a really key trend. Were there any other standout, you know, you don't need to name names of the projects, but just standout ideas that you're like, you know, we're in a kind of a bear market period. When we come out of this, those guys, that's going to be a hot sort of trend.
Yeah, there was. And you know, this actually was, there was an event going on simultaneously, which was affiliated with at Denver called DAO Denver. And I believe they're actually getting together now a sort of how you see ETH Portland, you see ETH Lisbon, you see there's sort of like a DAO thing like that forming, where there's like a quite a movement of like some sort of series of international events or things around DAOs. Particularly, I think, within the Ethereum community, but it may expand. But I did give a talk at DAO Denver as well. I have to say that I didn't quite realize, because at Offshift, we do have a community DAO that we're building and that has already made at least one minor decision for us. And really, DAOs are the future of how, if there's going to be any element of governance, any whatsoever, then a DAO is really, you want at least your community to have some sort of, you know, decentralized infrastructure by which they can make decisions and contribute. And so I think DAOs are, I did not realize how many DAOs are out there and how many sort of DAO projects are emerging, because I've been so focused on DeFi and in particular PriFi, where it's sort of like coming from this anarcho-capitalist PriFi purism angle, which is no governments, no central banks, no governance whatsoever. But there are people who say, we want to have decentralized systems, but there may be some element of governance. Like MakerDAO, as you mentioned, is being one of the best examples. People don't vote on, you know, how there's no real, you know, overarching governance. It's just based, what are the insurance rates that we want to have on the protocol? What are some assets that we want to support? What are some assets we don't want to support? You want those decisions to be made by the community. And DAO infrastructure, I think, is in its very early stages, but there's a lot of room for innovation there that's on the way.
Yeah, I'm excited for that kind of stuff. I guess kind of to round things out, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask your opinion on just the state of, you know, regulation, and, you know, of course, everything going on, you know, with BlockFi getting sued by the SEC, you know, Ripple maybe kind of showing a little bit of a stand against the SEC in recent court proceedings. That's kind of a new development. Do you think that, like, you know, Offshift has any regulatory headwinds or privacy coins in general?
No comment. No, you're bringing up questions.
Bringing the heat, baby.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most recent event was the executive order from the Biden administration.
Yeah, seemed pretty supportive.
It did. I mean, like for the most part, yeah. But I mean, there were six big areas of focus, and one was about making the US like a competitive, you know, environment for innovation in the crypto space. But there were two others which really stood out. One was illicit activity, and the second was inclusion. And, you know, this is where we run into the same issue every time, which is that the best intentions of regulators, this is where we run into, and we talked about this in the beginning of the talk, but it's so important. How can you really have these two sort of twin objectives? For how long can you have these two twin objectives before they start to conflict? You're trying to prevent illicit activity. The only way to do that is by monitoring, and that requires surveillance. You have to see the illicit activity to be able to prevent it in most situations. And you can see that they also want this element of inclusion. So assuming we're operating in a sort of innocent until proven guilty system, like you'd really like us to continue operating in that way for everyone's sake. If you're just doing something in a privacy-centric environment and you're all of a sudden, you know, attacked for doing that, or you're put on some list or whatever, or that system gets attacked by regulators first, those privacy-centric systems, then you're kind of cutting into the inclusivity and openness that the Web3 space and certainly cryptocurrency were supposed to be about since day one. So I think that's really the biggest challenge for regulators and for all of us operating in the space, which is that, yeah, let's remain true to the core founding principles of crypto. I mean, the word crypto comes from encryption, which is all about privacy, and that's really what the space right. is founded on. Even if it's pseudonymous, it's still better than nothing, but yeah, you'd like it to be fully anonymous. And I think, yeah, that's really like the big fight that we're for at Offshift. One, that's the one big point, is that, yeah, the pursuit of preventing illicit activity cannot conflict with the prerogative of inclusivity and openness and the freedom to transact openly, or at least privately also, but the freedom to transact as you wish, as long as you're not committing any crimes or committing violence on others. The second piece there, is that, and I think it's about to escape my mind, is that Oh yeah, it did. I just dropped it. But either way, in any event, like for us, as far as like, oh, just remembered it. Great.
There we go. Bringing it back.
The second piece is what I mentioned before. I got to say it before I forget again. Is like the key really to preventing, to like creating a robust censorship resistant system is to having it fully decentralized. Mm-hmm. And when you have a core team that's behind a project, that core team can be targeted. And so that's where a lot of these even great DeFi protocols, even if the DeFi protocol has a DAO and the DAO is telling the dev team what to do, you still have this centralized point of failure. And in a sense, a politician is a centralized point of failure, any kind of authority. So for us, like we're focused on, yeah, right now we have a core team to set things up and to get the ball rolling. But yeah, our goal is to create a DAO and a really well-educated and well-informed community so that the platform runs itself. That's really where I think every privacy-centric system should be aiming to get to. You don't want to have a core team where no matter how private the protocol is, you know, if you have a team, you have, you know, a crosshairs, you can, you know, that can be put there, for better or worse. Yeah. So DAOs are a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely second exactly what you're saying. I think DAOs, decentralized autonomous organization, DAO, for anybody who wants to go Google that at home or search our list of podcasts where we've done in the past. I think that's going to be a huge trend. It's going to be kind of what really brings to the forefront that, you know, we as people, right, can take back control of governance a little. I think, you know, we've gone a little far down the path in terms of how federal government and state governments are operating. And I think kind of relocalizing that into communities that you know we're active parts of, and kind of relocalizing that into, you know, the money and the sort of kind of shareholder-esque value that we share in one protocol. I think that is going to be the future. So I'm excited that you kind of brought that up. And now before we let you go, you know, as Crypto 101, you know, we have all sorts of brand new listeners on the show. What's just one word of advice from a crypto veteran, you know, to help these people on their way?
Okay. This is really important. If you are investing in the space, and this is not investment advice per se, but if you are involved in the space, I mean, cryptocurrency really is the internet for wealth and money. And value. So there's no way to avoid participating in cryptocurrency without getting your wealth involved, really, at the end of the day. Even and especially in DAOs, which require, you know,
yeah.
So as you are getting involved in the space, there's a book that I would recommend people read, which is called Trading in the Zone. It's by a guy named Mark Douglas.
Yeah, it's a great one.
You've read that book?
Oh yeah.
Oh my God, dude, no way.
Straight up.
Man.
Yep.
Oh man, we should go get some coffee after this.
Absolutely. Mark Douglas is the man.
He is the man. That guy is absolutely the man. Yeah. So, I mean, for every person out there that you've heard about who's become a crypto millionaire, there are probably 100 people who lost everything in crypto, but they're probably not posting about it on Twitter.
Bingo.
So it's really important to understand, because there are some really difficult experiences that you can have losing everything you own or a large amount of it more than you expected to in a space that is extremely volatile and extremely nascent. And so the kinds of mistakes that you'll make will have nothing to do with technical knowledge, nothing to do with technical analysis. They'll have absolutely nothing to do with your understanding of markets or technologies, but they're sort of your own familiarity or lack of familiarity with your own internal emotional environment. And becoming aware of that as a trader, as he calls it, a trader, but in this kind of paradigm, in this kind of situation, it's more just about any kind of time you're interacting with value and wealth. Mm-hmm. And there's a particular anecdote which he shares, which I would like to share, which is where there is one trader who is very, he loses a lot, but he's then working in some kind of brokerage or some firm. And the boss gives him an opportunity to come trade with him or sit beside him during the day. And they're looking at, I believe it's soybean futures contracts. And at this time, his book's written in the 80s, I believe, or 90s.
Yeah,
actually, might have been near 2000. But yeah, he's sitting beside the boss and he's talking about support and resistance levels to the boss. And the price of soybean futures or futures contracts, something along these lines, is ticking down to the support level. And the boss says, it's at the support level. Does that mean it's not going to go any lower? And he says, absolutely not. This is the lowest price of the day. So the boss gets on the phone, because that's what they did back then, and he calls up and he said, I'd like to sell a huge amount of soybean contracts, and the price dips below. And the boss says, that's bullshit. That's what he says to him right there. And it's sort of like, it's such a great lesson, because the guy is looking at it in horror, where he's like, that's the support level you're supposed to buy. But the point is that that's all it takes. One person in the market who disagrees with you to sort of prove you wrong. Mm-hmm. And so anything can happen. Every moment in the market is unique. You do not know what's going to happen in the future. Your favorite influencer does not know what's going to happen in the future. I definitely don't know what's going to happen next in the future. And you have to operate from a probabilistic, uncertain place if you want to retain or grow your wealth. So it's really important to understand that lesson. That's why I recommend the book to everyone.
Yeah, and that's so great. I'm glad that you brought that up. One of the big takeaways from that book for me was just the understanding that logic and emotion generally never occupy the brain at the same time. And so if you could identify in yourself and be aware when you're being hyper-emotional, whether that's hyper-fearful or hyper-greedy, and being able to counter-trade that is fantastic. And even I've applied it to my personal life, right? When I'm feeling heated in an argument, you know, just being like, okay, I feel that heat in my gut right now. My fists are clenched. I'm feeling maybe a little, you know, unfairly, you know, target or whatever. And then be like, okay, well, I'm not thinking logically, you know, I'm thinking irrationally with emotion. So let me step back, take a walk, get some logic flowing through the brain. And that's how you have to make your trading and investment decisions. So, Alex, that was great. Great way to close the episode here. If people want to find out more about Offshift, where are we pointing them? Do you like Discord? You guys big Telegram guys, Twitter?
I mean, you definitely find us on Offshift XFT on Twitter, or Alex Ship XFT on Twitter. But you know, yeah, our Telegram, you can find us offshift.io. If you go there, then you'll see all of our socials. Telegram and Discord both are big for us. Those will be our two biggest, yeah.
Great stuff. Alex Ship, Offshift, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll bring you back on when Mainnet gets launched, all right?
I can't wait. Yeah.
Sounds good. All right, everybody at home listening, stay tuned. We'll be back with some more guests later this week.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.